Greetings, everyone. Welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, the Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5, 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network, and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. It's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on personal identification. All right, in our personal identification, last time we were talking about Brown versus Texas, one of the key cases in this scenario of the policeman who walks up to you and asks you for identification. I thought I'd tell you a little story here. I had a student named Fred down in Deming, New Mexico. And Fred wanted to test Brown v. Texas down in Deming. He complained that the city council down there had created a law that required identification. Now, New Mexico happens to be one of the states that has this identification statute. California used to. They repealed it, and I guess they've reinstated it. Probably amended it so that it would meet constitutional muster. So 20 states have it, and 30 states don't. So in those states that do have the stop and identify law, it poses a problem for those of us that don't want to identify ourselves to the policeman. In the past, it's always been based upon Brown versus Texas and Lawson versus Colander. We don't have to identify yourself because we're protected by the Fourth and Fifth Amendments. But now in this new case, Heibel versus the Sixth Judicial District Court in Nevada, we have a distinguishing characteristic. The burden now shifts to us to prove or to show that we have a reasonable expectation that the information could be the beginning point of a criminal investigation used against us. Well, Fred, down in Deming, New Mexico, strapped on a .45 and walked down Main Street. In the process, Ranger Rick came along, saw him packing heat, and stopped to inquire as to who he was. I guess the cop had never seen him before. So when the policeman stopped, he was still in his car, he rolled the window down, and he said, "Hey, you." Fred stopped on the sidewalk, leaned down, looked in the window, and said, "Yes." And the policeman said, "Who are you? Give me some identification." Fred asked this question. He said, "Is this a criminal investigation?" The officer said, "No." Fred turned on his heel and said, "I don't want to talk to you," and he walked on down the street. Now, the officer was really ticked off. And Fred said he stepped on the gas and peeled rubber, slammed on his brakes, opened the door, jumped out, got up on the sidewalk right in front of Fred, got up in his face, and he said, in a loud, boisterous tone of voice, "I said I want to see some identification." Fred said, "Am I under arrest?" And the officer by now, who is so ticked off, said, "Yes, you are." And Fred said, "Well, in that case, then, I don't want to talk to you. I want to shut up." And he did. And from that point on, Fred didn't talk. So he was transported downtown, arrested, booked in, and did all those things that people normally do. He bailed out, which is a mistake. And that's another subject for another day that I teach in my civil rights class, because it fails to establish that Fred has been damaged to such a degree that it demands a remedy. It's called the shock the conscience test. So, well, anyway, Fred was released and he took the case into trial. It was dismissed in the local district court, whereupon Fred sued under the Civil Rights Act for the false arrest and false imprisonment and settled for $10,000 in a nuisance value out of court settlement, upon condition that the city council would repeal their local ordinance, which they did. So they had a local ordinance in addition to their state statute, or at that time, They had only local ordinances and not a state statute. This has been quite a few years ago now. Now, there's a case where it followed this Brown v. Texas rule right to the letter. Notice here that the officer arrested Fred in the second round. He got excited. If Fred had taken this case to the Supreme Court, then he had already, the policeman had already gone the extra step under the Miranda Doctrine and arrested him. Well, now once you're arrested, you're in custody. This goes beyond the Terry stop and frisk rule. Now, I might mention right about now that when we're dealing in law, we're not dealing with thousands of impenetrable and mystical words and vocabulary here that is impossible to understand or to comprehend or to learn. I estimate that there's about 400 words in law that you need to learn. If you want to have a good working vocabulary in law, it's not 4,000 or 40,000 words, it's about 400. Words like, or terms like, neutral criteria. That's a buzzword in law. Probable cause. Reasonable expectation of privacy. Truly and sincerely held. Vagueness. Imprecise terms. Reasonably related. Legitimate governmental interest. Reasonable suspicion. Unconstitutionally vague and ambiguous. You know, terms like that that the courts use to describe the terms and conditions that you and I have to live under. They're not incomprehensible. They're easy to learn. And once you have a working vocabulary of legal terms, now you're right up there with the lawyers. And remember, 90% of the lawyers in America are incompetent. At least the trial lawyers, that's what our Chief Justice Warren Burger told us back in 1978. I don't see anything that would tell me today that anything has changed from 1978 to 2004. Now, you don't have to be superior to, you just have to become competent to be superior to 90% of the lawyers in America. I mean, I didn't make the statement or the comment, it's our Chief Justice that told us 90% are incompetent. He ought to know. He has to deal with these fools day in and day out. Now, I've read to you an ad or two in here where James Nielsen, who is a professor of law at the Hastings Law School, says, hey, let me tell you about law school students and what they learn here. He said it's a cruel hoax. All right, so here at the law school, what our objective is to teach lay people, plumbers, carpenters, electricians, housewives, businessmen, people in every walk of life, how to deal with the legal system. And of course, this fellow, Mr. Heibel over here, I don't know what his legal background is. I don't know if he was a NAACP or a ACLU mole who was testing a legal issue or not. He must have had some kind of legal training or he wouldn't have taken on the policeman. You know, normal people, when the police say, what's your name, whip out their driver's license and tell them. Very rarely do you find somebody like a Brown v. Texas, a Lawson versus Colander, a Heibel versus Nevada, who says, hell no, I won't go. So whenever you see one of these cases, almost invariably, it's a test case. Lawson versus Colander was a test case. Lawson was a black fellow down in San Diego, California. Lawson operates a law school similar to what I do. He trains pro se litigants, probably most of them black. More power to him. If there's anybody that needs legal training in America, it's America's blacks and Hispanics. It's the minorities. The whites don't need nearly as much legal training because they're politically in the majority, well, at least temporarily. That's going to end shortly, but meanwhile, back on the farm, this black guy, Lawson, had been arrested, you know, I don't know, 10, 15 times. And one day he woke up and he said, you know, I need a remedy for this. blacks down in Southern California have been complaining for years that they're discriminated against. I don't doubt that. So anyway, one night, Lawson, about 2 o'clock in the morning, says, well, we need a test case. So he went in his living room, picked up his television set, walked out on the sidewalk in front of his house at 2 o'clock in the morning and started walking up and down in front of his house. Pretty soon, Ranger Rick, on patrol, sees this black guy carrying a TV set on the sidewalk, pulls up and stops, and I imagine he asks some questions like, what's your name? Lawson told him where to get off, stepped back onto his lawn, and the confrontation was off and running. Case ultimately went up to the Supreme Court, and Lawson won. In fact, he was paid $130,000 for his false arrest and false imprisonment. Now, here's the point I want to make. In the case of Lawson, who collected $130,000, if you were the state of California, and you had a product that you were selling, called Identify Yourself to the Policeman or Go to Jail. And it's unconstitutional. It's illegal. It's as phony as a $3 Federal Reserve note. But every year you're fining people $75, $100, $150, and it generates $6 million a year in fines from you Californians out there, even though the law is patently unconstitutional, been declared so by the Supreme Court. Would you take that law off your books? I mean, come on, boys and girls. We've got an illegal product. Once in a while, we pay out $130,000, maybe once every 10 or 15 years. And meanwhile, we rake in $6 million a year, year in and year out, with this unconstitutional law. Why would we take it off the books? Because you think that the state of California is honest and law-abiding? You think the police are honest and law-abiding? I mean, come on, boys and girls. Let's grow up and get real. You see, the Supreme Court has a code or a philosophy that covers that. If the people of California want to keep this unconstitutional law in the books, you know, like identify yourself to a policeman or a vagrancy statute, it's okay. There's no problem with that. And if you want to walk in and plead guilty to a crime, you certainly have a right to do that, even though that crime is not even on the books. It's unconstitutional. I remember one time years ago, I had a business partner, and we had a little tussle with the EPA, and the EPA charged our company and Peter and I with polluting the air. And they went to California and took the wording out of the statute in California, applied it to an Idaho statute that had been reserved. There was no law in Idaho concerning air quality. And they charged us under Idaho Code 19-407, I believe it was, 19-407. And they wanted to prosecute and fine us 33 counts, $500 each, $17,500, and a year in jail for each one of these counts, or 6 months in jail, I forgot which. Oh, I think it was a $1,000 fine and 6 months in jail. I had it backwards. We're facing 17 and a half years in jail and $33,000 in fines. We had an attorney. So we have our company attorney, and we went to the company attorney, and he arranged a plea bargain. During the process of the plea bargain, I decided that I wanted to consult another attorney. He said he could win the case. In fact, he did go in and win the case. But my partner, Peter, pled guilty to polluting the air, while when I went to trial, the case was dismissed because there was no statute. Now, our attorney that we paid good money to, thousands of dollars to, he didn't research the statute. My partner pled guilty to a law that didn't exist, and I was exonerated. That was one of my brighter days in life. Now, could my partner go in and have his conviction set aside? No. He went in and pled guilty to a crime that didn't exist, to a law that had never been enacted, and paid a $300 fine and asked the judge to put him on probation for 6 months because he might do it again. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour. The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, the lessons that you hear here on the air concerning courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this show are just a small part of my two-week basic courtroom strategy and procedure school. And this school includes lessons on what to do and what not to do when you're arrested or when you're served with a summons, a citation, or a complaint. Now, rule number one is don't say anything. Keep your mouth shut and shut up. Now, if you could learn rule one, you could win about 86% of your legal cases. And that's because all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. And your government is fully capable of making their own case without any help from you whatsoever. Now listen to what the courts have to say about keeping quiet in the face of police interrogation. Indeed, not just police interrogation, but sometimes police intimidation. The first judge said this. Comes from U.S. versus Dickerson. He said, "Who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights?" Shocking, isn't it? The second judge said this in Belknap versus United States. He said, quote, "You can and must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment." The third judge said, in Marchetti versus United States, quote, "The constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent as well as the innocent and the farsighted." Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me here at the law school? It's 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. Remember, it's entertaining, educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedures available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. You better do it right now before you forget. Just write it down, georgegordon.org. See how simple that is? Click onto the email, send me an email, or write the number down. The telephone number, 417-273-4967. And while you're at it, if you'd like a copy of this article that I got on, do the police have a duty to protect you from crime? Do the police have a legal responsibility or duty? They got a sign on the side of the car and it says, to protect and serve. Does that mean to protect and serve you, Joe, six-pack taxpayer citizen? The answer is absolutely not. There's no legal responsibility or liability. If you called the police and said, there's a burglar breaking in my house, the police don't come out, don't respond, the burglar comes in, shoots you, and you sue the police, you will lose every time. The police have no duty to come out and protect you from a crime or a criminal. You pay for it with your taxes, but there's no legal liability. Now, I know that's pretty shocking, and I'll send you that article, and I'll share with you the 12 questions that I came up with. Not to be construed, by the way, as legal advice. But I'll show you what I'm going to ask the policeman when he asks me, "Hey, you, what's your name?" "Hey, you, what's your name?" How am I going to respond? I'll tell you how I'll respond. Drop a $5 bill in an envelope, send it to me, and I'll send you the article and the 12 questions. You can stick it in your jockey box. You can stick it in your wallet. Because now, under this new Hybel rule, if you want to use this, if you want to be a Brown, you want to be a Lawson, you want to be a Gordon, you want to be a Prowse, then you're going to have to be the guy that takes the bull by the horns and says, "Wait a minute, I've got to determine whether or not I'm the target of this investigation and whether or not you're going to arrest me, whether or not I'm in some kind of risk here by telling you what my name is." The burden is on you to show that there is indeed a risk, and I've told you what that is already. There may be a warrant out for your arrest. So you ought to know how to answer and how to ask questions, at least concerning this. Now, the last time we were talking about Brown v. Texas, now listen to what the court had to say about Brown. They went on to say here, the state does not contend that the appellant was stopped pursuant to a practice embodying neutral criteria, but rather maintains that the officers were justified in stopping the appellant because they had reasonable, articulable suspicion that a crime had just been, was being, or was about to be committed. And we've recognized that in some circumstances an officer may retain and then detain a suspect briefly for questioning, although he does not have probable cause to believe that the suspect is involved in criminal activity, as is required for a traditional arrest. You can see that in United States versus Brignani Ponce, Terry versus Ohio. However, we have required the officers to have a reasonable suspicion based on objective facts that the individual is involved in criminal activity, as we did in Delaware versus Prowse. Now, the flaw in the state's case in Brown versus Texas is that none of the circumstances preceding the officer's detention of the appellant justified a reasonable suspicion that he was involved in any criminal activity. No criminal activity. So Officer Venegas testified at the appellant's trial that the situation in the alley looked suspicious, but he was unable to point to any facts supporting that conclusion. There's no indication in the record that it was unusual for people to be in the alley. The fact that the appellant was in a neighborhood frequented by drug users standing alone isn't a basis for concluding that the appellant himself is engaged in any criminal conduct or drug trafficking. In short, the appellant's activity was no different from the activity of any other pedestrian in that neighborhood. And then, when pressed, Officer Venegas acknowledged that the only reason he stopped the appellant was to ascertain his identity. The purpose for the stop was to determine his identity. He doesn't have any right to do that. The police, to this day, including Heibel, they don't have any power to just stop you to find out who you are, absent articulable, reasonable suspicion. So your job then is to create the defense to the articulable, reasonable suspicion, or the higher standard, probable cause. Or, if you're arrested, shut up altogether. But prior to actually being arrested, under Terry, the policeman can detain you. You're not free to go, but you're not under arrest. You're kind of in the twilight zone. This is where Heibel was. He was in the twilight zone. And now, we have to be able to ask articulable, specific questions to show that we have a reasonable basis for believing that the testimonial evidence of giving our names to the policeman could be the beginning point of a criminal investigation to be used against us. Now, the record suggests an understandable desire to assert a police presence. However, that purpose does not negate Fourth Amendment guarantees. Now, in the absence of any basis for suspecting the appellant of any misconduct, the balance between the public interest and the appellant's right to personal security and privacy tilts in favor of freedom from police interference. The Texas statute under which the appellant was stopped and required to identify himself is designed to advance a weighty social objective in large metropolitan centers, and that is the prevention of crime. But even assuming that purpose is served to some degree by stopping and demanding identification from an individual without any specific basis for believing that he's involved in criminal activity, the guarantees of the Fourth Amendment don't allow it. It's not allowed. So when such a stop is not based on objective criteria, remember I said you got these buzzwords? Nothing in Brown has changed. But you have to have objective criteria. The risk of arbitrary and abusive police practices exceeds the tolerable limits, as we decided in Delaware versus Prowse. So the application of the Texas Penal Code to detain the appellant and require him to identify himself violated the Fourth Amendment because the officers lacked any reasonable suspicion to believe that the appellant was engaged or had engaged in any criminal conduct. Accordingly, the appellant may not be punished for refusing to identify himself, and the conviction is reversed. Now hang on, we got to take a break here. We'll be right back, and we'll take a look And I'm going to show you here the appendix to the opinion of the court. In fact, I don't think I'll take the break right here. Just hang on. Let me give you the opinion. We'll take our break here in a minute. Hang on, break time. Here's what the court had to say. It's fairly short to the point. The court said, now, what do you think about it? If you stop a person lawfully, and then if he doesn't want to talk to you, you put him in jail for committing a crime. Now, Mr. Patton answers. Now, Patton is the Attorney General of Texas. And so here we are. Get the picture here. Here's the Supreme Court of the United States. Nine guys sitting up here at this big long bench. And here comes Patton. He's the AG of Texas. And the judges are asking the Attorney General these questions. And they said, hey, you, AG, what do you think about if you stop a person lawfully, and then if he doesn't want to talk to you, you put him in jail for committing a crime? Patton, the prosecutor, said, well, first of all, I would question the defendant's statement in his motion that the First Amendment gives an individual the right to silence. The court, I'm asking you, why should the state put you in jail because you don't want to say anything? Patton, the AG, says, well, I think there's certain interests that have to be viewed. The court responds, okay, tell me, what are those interests? Patton says, well, the governmental interest to maintain the safety and security of the society and the citizens to live in the society, and then there are certainly strong governmental interests in that direction, and because of that, these interests outweigh the interests of the individual for a certain amount of intrusion upon his personal liberty. I think these governmental interests outweigh the individual's interests in this respect, as far as simply asking an individual for his name and address under proper circumstances. Here's the AG. What he's saying is, when you translate that is, we think the Fourth Amendment sucks, it ought to be kicked out, and we ought to have total police dictatorship over citizens. That's what he's saying. Today they would word it, well, we're looking for terrorists, which is a bunch of crap. They use the word terrorist and terrorists in police circles today to justify these unconstitutional intrusions into our Bill of Rights. Well, it's not the unconstitutional intrusions that are allowed by the courts. Listen to the court. Mr. Patton, again, I can only contend that, or excuse me, the court rather responds to that and says, but why should it be a crime to not answer? And Patton responds, well, again, I can only contend that if an answer is not given, it tends to disrupt. The court comes back and says, what does it disrupt? And Patton comes back and says, well, I think it tends to disrupt the goal of this society to maintain security over its citizens. Notice that, security over its citizens, to make sure that they are secure in their gains and in their homes. May your chains rest lightly upon your shoulders. The court followed up and said, well, how does that secure anybody by forcing them under penalty of being prosecuted to give their name and address even though they're lawfully stopped? And Patton says, well, under the circumstances in which some individuals would be lawfully stopped, it's presumed that perhaps this individual is up to something, and the officer is doing his duty simply to find out what the individual's name and address is and to determine what exactly is going on. The court came back with this final response and said, I'm not questioning. I'm not asking whether the officer shouldn't ask the questions. I'm sure they should ask everything they possibly can find out. What I'm asking you is, what's the state's interest in putting a man in jail because he doesn't want to answer? And the court went on to say, I realize lots of times an officer will have a defendant, a Miranda warning. He'll give him the Miranda warning, which means the defendant doesn't have to make a statement. Lots of defendants go ahead and confess. That's fine. If they want to confess, that's great. But if they don't confess, you can't put them in jail, can you, for refusing to confess to a crime. So, boys and girls, our job is to show then that under this new Heibel case that we're being compelled to confess to a crime. Hang on. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of my two-week basic courtroom strategy and procedure school. Remember, the classes include lessons on what to do and what not to do at the scene of this alleged crime. What should you say to the police or investigators, and what you ought not to say to the police. And you'll learn how to conduct yourself and your case at bail setting, arraignment, pleadings, motion hearings, trial, and appeal, just like this guy Brown did. And you'll learn how to ask questions, cross-examine adverse witnesses, select a jury, introduce exhibits and evidence, conduct discovery, do legal research, and follow the rules of court. Now, there are 28 things, 28 elements that you need to learn in courtroom strategy and procedure. Rule one is that all of the evidence that your opponent is ever going to use against you is going to be furnished by you. So keep your mouth shut, don't say anything, and shut up. And then after rule one's out of the way, we can get to the real business of winning your case. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me? The number's 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedure is also available on compact disc for adult home education. Now, that's the school. Two-week school, two binders, 1,000 pages of material, plus all of the CDs to give you the instruction, to tell you, here's the way the game is played. 28 things you need to know. Now, if you're online, you can just go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email, and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Would you do that? It's free of charge, three discs, about 4 hours, as I recall. And let me tell you a little bit more about what it is that your government doesn't want you to know. I mean, after all, if you're the sovereign power, don't you think that as the sovereign power, the master, you ought to at least know as much as your servants, the police? Won't that level out the playing field for you? If you just knew as much as the police, your servants, you'd at least be on an even footing with them, wouldn't you? And you can get on that even footing if you're online. Go to the webpage. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email. Send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Would you do that? Do it right now before you forget. Or you can call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, there's the story on Brown v. Texas. That concludes that story. The Supreme Court reamed the AG of Texas a new anal aperture for the express purpose of making a point. If a guy doesn't want to talk, what are you arresting him for? Now, the minority in the Heibel case followed that same line of reasoning. But Heibel, remember, failed at the scene to allege his Fourth Amendment rights. And the majority who distinguished Heibel from Brown said he failed to make that Fourth Amendment point. And he also failed to make his Fifth Amendment point. So they said, well, the statute is constitutional because Heibel failed to make the two points that he needed to make. That was because he was represented by the public defender's office. I think he'd have done a better job of it by himself. And it could well be that the public defender's office knew what the two critical points to be made were, but did not make those points, and they did it on purpose, so that this case would come out the way it did. Let me tell you that sometimes you can get a fifth columnist into your camp for the express purpose of turning out propaganda. It happened some years back in a case called Morton Grove, Illinois. And the little town of Morton Grove, Illinois, passed an ordinance, a gun control ordinance, a law that's patently unconstitutional, but you know, it doesn't make any difference if your city or town passes a law that's patently unconstitutional. The people in the town don't know it anyway, don't know how to defend against it, probably agree with it, and would plead guilty to it because they don't want to take the time, effort, or energy to defend their rights. And people that don't want to defend their rights aren't entitled to rights. They're entitled to privileges, they're entitled to perks and benefits, but not rights. They're entitled to do what their masters tell them to do. They need somebody to tell them when to get up in the morning, when to go to bed at night, and what to do in between. Our founding fathers didn't subscribe to that kind of a military frame of mind, you know, where you join the army and somebody tells you when to get up, when to go to bed, and what to do in between. They thought that people should have capacity, property, rights, freedoms, liberties, immunities, and that they ought to be able to express those and enforce those in court. And that's why they wrote our Constitution and Bill of Rights. It's patterned after the Mosaic Law, which is designed to protect private property, like thou shalt not steal, is the basis of all property rights. Without it, there are no property rights. Today in America, we practice the first plank of the Communist Manifesto, which calls for the abolition of all rights to property. Thou shalt not steal establishes your right to property. That's why we abolish the Bible from public schools. We don't want rights. We want privileges. Well, Morton Grove enacts this city ordinance, and it says you can't have a gun in the city of Morton Grove. So a lawyer comes along, a champion of the people, a lawyer who is going to protect our Second Amendment. He is going to use his expertise, and he's going in to defend the Second Amendment for all of us. God bless him. So he sues the city of Morton Grove in state district court, and he is summarily dismissed without a hearing. Well, I wouldn't say without a hearing. He probably had one hearing. And they said, you don't have any standing. Kicked him out of court. No jury trial. No case on the merits. No testimony. No witnesses. No evidence. No decision. He's just summarily dismissed. And that should tell you a little part of the secret right there. This guy's a lawyer. He brings a suit, and he can't get the case qualified for trial. What the hell kind of a lawyer files a lawsuit and can't qualify his case for trial? I mean, the jury may rule against him, but you've got to be so damn poor not to be able to qualify your case for trial, and this guy's got a license to practice law, and you're going to pay this fool money? I mean, come on, boys and girls, let's grow up and get real. The first clue is that he gets dismissed out. But undaunted, our hero, our lawyer, he appeals to the Illinois Court of Appeals, who in turn summarily dismiss him out. Now, here's the second court. And this court, with three judges sitting there, agreed with the single judge at the district court, this fool doesn't even have a case, and dismissed him out. We're not going to consider reinstating the case. We're not going to consider any of the merits of the case, your complaint, or the answer. We're out of here. Undaunted, our hero, the lawyer, appeals to the Illinois Supreme Court. God bless him anyway. Thank God we have people like these lawyers that want to protect our Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. And the Illinois Supreme Court does the same thing. They kick him out. No standing. Now, one day I was in my office at Barrister's Inn up in Boise, Idaho. I used to operate that Barrister's Inn. And one of my students said, well, have you been reading about Morton Grove? And I said, well, nothing more than I read here in the newspaper. And he said, well, how do you think the court is going to rule? Now, he appealed it to the U.S. Supreme Court. And I said, without so much as with a hesitation, I said, why, the Supreme Court's not going to hear that. It's already been kicked out three times. Obviously, the guy doesn't have any standing. I don't know what the reason is that he doesn't have standing. I do now because I read up a little more on the case, but At that time, I didn't know, but I said, I'll guarantee you, the U.S. Supreme Court isn't going to hear the case. If it hasn't been heard by and ruled on by the state of Illinois, the U.S. Supreme Court isn't going to hear that case. And I said, furthermore, I'll make a prediction. When the case is reported in the Idaho Statesman, the headlines will be about two columns high, and it's going to say, U.S. Supreme Court upholds Morton Grove gun control ordinance. Well, the Idaho Statesman's actual headline was a couple of words different than that, but essentially that's what they said. U.S. Supreme Court upholds Morton Grove gun control ordinance. As they denied certiorari and denied or refused to hear the case. Now, why did they refuse to hear the case? It comes under Ashwander versus Tennessee Valley Authority. There's no standing. This guy has not been damaged by the operation of the statute. Heibel's got standing. He's been damaged. He was arrested and jailed. This lawyer was never arrested and jailed. There's no vital controversy at issue here. He couldn't even follow the 7 rules to qualify a case for appellate review. This lawyer, our champion? No, he's not a champion. He's not on our side. He's a gun grabber. And he's probably working for the coalition to abolish gun and gun ownership in America or something like that. And he did that with specificity. He did it on purpose. It was a propaganda coup. The Supreme Court never ruled on the issue at all. They never rendered any opinion. In Heibel, they rendered an opinion. They said, we're going to distinguish Heibel from Brown and Lawson. Delaware versus Prowse and Miranda and 4 or 5 other cases, this is a distinguishable case. This guy here, and because of the statute, needs to be distinguished, and they did it. Morton Grove was a charade. It was a charade pulled off by a gun-grabbing lawyer. Now, I'm not suggesting that in the Heibel case, the Nevada Public Defender's Office deliberately took this case up so that they could overturn Brown v. Texas or Lawson v. Colander. But I wouldn't be surprised if that was their motivation. So I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. The Nevada Public Defender's Office was just plain incompetent. They just simply fell into that 90% of the lawyers in America who were incompetent, as Chief Justice Warrenberger told us back in 1978 while he was speaking to the American Bar Association in Las Vegas, Nevada, 1978. Justice Berger said, hey, these clowns are incompetent. So let's not ascribe any malice to the Public Defender's Office. Let's just give them their due and say, well, they didn't know what they were doing. In both the Brown and Lawson cases, Brown and Lawson advanced legitimate Fourth Amendment concerns and legitimate Fifth Amendment concerns. The Supreme Court heard them, didn't distinguish them, and said, why should you have to identify yourself? Now, I'm not suggesting that Mr. Heibel here was in some case lax in failing at the scene of the crime to assert these facts. But the Public Defender's Office was certainly lax in not asserting that the law was vague and ambiguous. Notice that the majority opinion said they didn't even raise the defense. They didn't even raise the issue. You know, we don't know what the trial court testimony was. We don't know what was said out there at the scene of the crime between the Heibel and the officer. All we know is what was reported, or what was, in this case, has failed to be reported to the court. And that is that he didn't advance a reasonable belief that he was going to be prosecuted for some other crime, or that this didn't meet Fourth Amendment scrutiny. All right, now hang on here a second. I'm going to take one more break, and then we'll be back, and let's take a look at Lawson versus Colander. The Lawson case, remember the black guy that picked up his television set and walked out in front of his house, up and down on in front of the of his house on the sidewalk. That was a test case. He was looking for a cop, wasn't he? And he found one and collected $130,000 for his trouble. Let's see how Lawson fared out. You know, when I'm asked who I would recommend for a lawyer, I recommend Jerry Spence of Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Now, you probably can't afford Mr. Spence any more than you could afford Johnny Cochran or F. Lee Bailey. So then my second choice is you. And when I'm teaching class and I'm talking to students, I tell them, that's right. You know, you are the best guy to represent your interests in court. And the reason for that is because you were there at the scene. And you either did it or you didn't do it. You know who else was there. You know what was said. You know who said it. You know who's lying. You know who's telling the truth. In short, you know. But your lawyer doesn't know any more than you tell him. And 90% of the lawyers that you hire are incompetent. Besides that, nobody likes a lawyer anyway. Now, representing yourself in court or at trial is protected by the Sixth Amendment. It's called pro se litigation. Three rules come into play, and that is, don't say anything, keep quiet, and shut up. Now, if you'd like to learn more about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative, and it's free of charge. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure is available. If you can't come to the law school itself, which is what I recommend, I like to talk to you person to person across the table with four or five other people in class so that you can ask questions and you can interact. But if you can't, for whatever reason, we put this on compact disc and you can learn right there in the comfort of your own home. It's on compact disc with all the paperwork that goes with it. Now, if you're online, just go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email. Send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Or call direct, 417-273-4967. Now, in the conversation that we're having, the analysis of the Heibel case as it relates to Brown v. Texas and Lawson v. Colander, many of you students have written me letters. Now, you've already been through school. You already know Lawson. You already know Brown. Drop a $5 bill in an envelope and send it here to the law school. That's Post Office Box 297 for those of you that are strangers here. P.O. Box 297, Isabella, Missouri. That's spelled I-S-A-B-E-L-L-A, Missouri M-O, 65676. Just stick $5 in to cover the cost of printing. Let me copy some questions and an article that you need in regards to this thing of, do the police have any duty to protect you? You know, they come up to you and they say, hey, we're here to protect and serve. And they are. They're there to protect and serve JCPenney, Sears Roebuck, Circle K, and 7-Eleven. They are not there to protect Joe Sixpack citizen, Joe or Jane Sixpack taxpayer. There's no legal liability, no legal responsibility there. So if you want to be defended, if you want to be protected, you're going to do it yourself and you're going to do it under the Second Amendment. And there's just nobody in the world better competent or qualified to protect you, your rights, and your interests than you are. You've got constitutional rights in the Supreme Court of every state, the appellate courts, and the judges in your local district would just love to help you in your quest. You know, I've been in this business for 22 years, and I can tell you that except for two judges that are total jerks, I haven't met any other judges that are jerks. And there aren't any jerks in federal practice at all. Federal judges don't get to be federal judges because they don't know what they're talking about. And I've sat across the table, sat across the desk from many federal judges, Judge Ryan, Judge Callison, Judge Clark, who have told me across the counter, nobody cares about your rights, Gordon, except you and the claims manager of the insurance industry. And if you want to assert your rights, you're going to do it yourself, or it isn't going to get done. Now, on the bench, they'll caution you, and they'll give you the standard canned tripe that says, now you need a lawyer, you know, and I can't act as your lawyer for you, and you better go out and hire a lawyer. But that's not what they believe in private. That's not what they tell you behind the scenes back in chambers. They know that 90% of the lawyers out there that come before them don't know whether their rectums are bored or punched. And they'll tell you so. But they also know that most pro se litigants don't have any special training and don't know the rules of procedure, don't know those 28 things that you have to know if you're going to be successful in court. So the only other alternative for you then is to hire an incompetent lawyer, because you as a pro se litigant are going to be more incompetent, less competent, less able to present your case than an incompetent lawyer. That's why I open barristers in to teach lay people these 28 things that you need to know in order to become competent and qualified to present a case in trial. Now, if you can learn from a Time Life book to do your own plumbing or your own carpentry or do it yourself, you can learn to be competent and qualified. You know, you don't have to be superior to, you just have to be competent. Just as competent as a lawyer is competent. That puts you ahead of 90% of the lawyers who are incompetent. And I didn't say that the lawyers are incompetent. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court said they were incompetent. 90% of them. So here at the law school, our objective is to just bring you up to competence, which puts you ahead of 90% of the lawyers in America. All right. Now remember, if you put that $5 in the mail there, I'll give you these 12 questions that I'm going to ask the police. This is my opinion, by the way. This is not legal advice. I'm not a lawyer, and I don't give legal advice. I'm just saying, well, here's my opinion. Here's what I would do. And you can get this case, by the way. You want this case. It's called Heibel versus 6th Judicial District. The number now is 035554. Remember, that's 035554. Click on to Find Law. It's on the web, Find Law, FINDLAW. And then click on to 035554, and you can get this printed out right there in the convenience of your own den on your own computer, 13 pages. And then if you want, I'll share with you what it is you need to know about this case by sending you the questions that will qualify you for this Fourth and Fifth Amendment. Fourth and Fifth Amendment. How do I want to word this now? I'm looking at the word excuse here, you know, or the relevance of your claim that you qualify for Fourth and Fifth Amendment exemption in giving your name to the policeman. Now, that isn't going to be in every case. You know, if you're just standing there as a witness, you can't take a blanket Fifth, and you can't use the Fifth Amendment unless it's going to involve you personally in a criminal prosecution. You have to believe and you have to show that it's going to involve you. Just tell them the cop, it's none of your business, isn't going to fly any longer. Well, let me give you a little basis here for this thing of Lawson versus Colander. A California statute requires persons who loiter or wander on the streets to provide credible and reliable identification and to account for their presence when they're requested to do so by a peace officer. Well, the California Court of Appeals has construed the statute to require a person to provide such identification when requested by a police officer who has reasonable suspicion of criminal activity sufficient to justify a stop under the standards of Terry versus Ohio. The California court has defined credible and reliable identification as carrying reasonable assurance that the identification is authentic and providing means for later getting in touch with the person who has identified himself. I'll pause here. Evidently, what the California statute required was that you had to have a driver's license, social security number, state identification, or some kind of credible. Notice the word credible. What do you do with people like the Amish who don't have social security numbers, don't drive, don't have driver's licenses? How do they get credible identification? You mean we have to go to the state to be identified? We, the sovereigns? Oh, come on. Let's come down to earth, boys and girls. There's no law that requires you to have identification. The fact that you were taught to identify yourself in the first grade and to waive all of your civil and constitutional rights all of your life doesn't mean that you have to continue to do that forever. You know, at some point in time, if you decide that you'd like to regain your capacity and assert your rights to live as a common law free man, you have a right to do that. Now, if you've been a bondservant or a slave working on the California plantation all of your life, it's understandable that this may be a little strange to your ears. But sometimes, once in a while, a person will actually come to his senses and say, wait a minute, there are rights here. These rights are not privileges. They're not grants from the state, not grants from my guardian or my master. I want to assert my rights. If you ever come to that position or that point, let me know. The appealee, who had been arrested and convicted under the statute, brought an action in federal district court challenging the statute's constitutionality. The district court held the statute unconstitutional and enjoined its enforcement, and the Court of Appeals affirmed. It was held that the statute is drafted and as construed by the state court as unconstitutionally vague on its face within the meaning of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment by failing to clarify what is contemplated by the requirement that a suspect provide credible and reliable identification. That was the Achilles heel of the former California statute. It was vague and ambiguous, declared to be unconstitutional on its face. So as such, the statute vests virtually complete discretion in the hands of the police to determine whether the suspect has satisfied the statute and must be permitted to go on his way in the absence of probable cause to arrest. I had a student one time. He was involved in a traffic accident. He gave the cop his business card to identify himself, and the cop arrested him because the policeman determined that the business card was not credible evidence of his identity. And, of course, the student won that case later on because of Lawson versus Colander and the fact that I don't have to give you any credible evidence. And he didn't. Well, we're just about out of time, and we're going to have to take our break here or leave here for the day. This is a good enough place for us to do it. We'll conclude this program of Heibel versus 6th Judicial District and personal identification with this case called Lawson versus Colander. When we come back with session 5, that's tomorrow night, on personal identification with Lawson versus Colander. Well, you've been listening here to The Law Hour, an editorial review. It's sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network. And we're heard worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, an editorial review, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log, schedule of archives. It can be accessed through my website at georgegordon.org. If you want a copy of these 12 questions and the article on personal identification and police responsibility to protect you, just drop a $5 bill in an envelope and send it with your name and address to cover the costs of copying and printing and mailing it out, and we'll be happy to share it with you. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Well, there's the signal. It says our time is up, so we'll have to leave it right there. And I'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing. So until then, goodbye, friends.